It is Tuesday, April 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, it's decision time for Republicans and Democrats in New York State to choose their preferred nominee for this year's presidential election. Our national correspondent will be here to tell us why this primary is so important. I'll speak with a Middle East reporter for BuzzFeed News about a deadly airstrike in northwestern Syria and who may have been behind it. We'll get an update on the spread of the Zika virus in the United States. And we'll tell you about a new Kenyan musical that's bringing African folklore to life. It's all ahead on International Edition. Well, New York voters headed to the polls on Tuesday for presidential nominating primaries, with pre-election surveys showing Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump holding strong leads over their challengers. For more on that, I'm joined in the studio by VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Michael.
So what are you expecting to see from today's primaries?
The expectations on both sides are big nights for Republican Donald Trump and for Democrat Hillary Clinton. And let's face it, it's their home state right now. It's also the place where Bernie Sanders was born and raised, in Brooklyn. And I think the Sanders people are hoping maybe to pull some sort of a surprise here. But all the polls show Clinton has a healthy lead and Trump has, as he would say, a huge lead over his rivals, Ted Cruz and John Kasich.
What would a Trump win mean for the Republican race? And also, how significant is the extent of a potential Trump victory?
Yeah, good questions. I mean, the thing is, he's coming off a rough patch, Donald Trump. He lost in Wisconsin. He was on the defensive over a variety of issues and statements he's made. In the last few weeks, we've seen him turn a corner. He's hired more experienced people in his campaign. He's not as volatile as we've seen in the past. And I think what they want to do with a big victory in New York is show that he's ready for prime time and that he's on track to get very close, if not secure, the number of delegates he needs before the convention in July so that he can avoid a contested convention. And the reason for that, again, is that there's a feeling that if it goes beyond the first ballot in Cleveland, Trump could be in trouble because Ted Cruz is already getting commitments from some of the Trump delegates who have to vote for Trump on the first ballot. They might switch to Cruz. And I think the whole point now of the Trump campaign, get all the delegates you can before the convention, try to nail down that nomination ahead of time.
And how much closer would Trump get to that majority of 1237 if he pulls out a big win today?
You know, it'll depend somewhat on the margin of victory, the percentage of votes he gets. There are 95 delegates at stake, 14 statewide. So he's looking good for those. But it's then done by congressional district. In each district, every time he goes above 50%, he would get all three of the delegates at stake in that district. So he'll want a really big showing. Now, Cruz and Kasich have to be a little bit more strategic and just hope to pick off delegates here and there by holding Trump to a lower percentage. So they then would then fight on in primaries coming down the road.
Well, looking at the Democratic side, if Sanders gets close to Hillary Clinton, does that help him much in his bid to overtake her or not really?
Not a great deal, that's right. In fact, he needs to win about 64% of the remaining delegates to really catch her in the nomination battle in the delegate count. And this is what makes the Bernie Sanders road so difficult. He has such an uphill hill to climb. You know, he'd like to have a surprising showing in New York that might fuel a little bit of a comeback. But right now, you'll see a conversation may shift if Clinton can score a big victory. Democrats may want them to cool it a bit and stop going after each other.
And even if Sanders does get a greater than expected number of delegates, Hillary's also going to get delegates. So
yes, she
will. Doesn't make up much ground.
Democratic side, it's all allocated, unlike the Republicans, where some states are winner take all.
Well, thank you very much, Jim Malone. We'll definitely come back to you to find out how those results shake out later tonight. Thanks
sure.
so much. Well, also in the studio with us is G. Abby Lee for our social media segment. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael.
So what are the contenders saying on social media today about this primary?
So I think we can agree that the GOP contender Ted Cruz's comment on the so-called New York values They're probably not serving him too well today. The Washington Post has an article titled Ted Cruz and the Revenge of New York Values. The Texas senator threw away his chance to be at least moderately competitive in the delegate-heavy state.
Well, what did he write?
On Facebook, he wrote, let's liberate families from tax stress and hashtag abolish the IRS. So he doesn't appear to be banking on winning tonight.
Yeah, abolish the IRS is definitely one of Ted Cruz's big themes. Mm-hmm. Well, what about the other two GOP contenders?
The frontrunner Donald Trump wrote, I love you, New York. Do not forget to get out and hashtag vote Trump today. Thank you all for all of your incredible support. It is time to make America great again. John Kasich wrote, New York, we're facing some big challenges. We need a president who is ready on day one. Now, if the reactions on social media are indicative of voter sentiment, Trump is going to win big tonight. His video posted on Facebook just 3 hours ago received 22,000 reactions, while Kasich's posted 8 hours ago received just over 2,000 reactions. That's a difference of whopping 20,000 reactions.
So that's one battle that Trump is winning online. Mm-hmm. What about the Democratic contenders? How have they been sounding off on social media?
So the first thing I noticed when I went to Hillary Clinton's Twitter page is the profile image. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again, she has a very savvy team of social media campaign staffers. They already changed the Twitter image to a picture of her laughing with the letters, Today is a Day NY. She also posted two videos, one specifically targeting New York and another one about her career achievements. Bernie Sanders, for his part, focused more on issue-oriented tweets. One of the latest tweets is about the need to stop fracking. He did share one video this afternoon titled Love Trump's Hate.
Oh, boy.
So I don't know if the use of the word Trump is an accident or whether that was deliberate. My guess is just as good as yours, Michael.
Yeah, I'm going to go with a deliberate guess there. So thanks very much to G. Abby Lee. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. And the show is there as well at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
It's the newest tool in the battle against diabetes, a high-tech electrochemical patch worn daily in a transparent band around the wrist to detect temperature, pH level, and glucose level from the sweat of the wearer. But it's more than that. When the patch senses the wearer needs medication, microneedles accurately deliver it from inside the patch. It was developed by Professor Kim Dae-hyung of Seoul National University.
Diabetics are very reluctant to measure blood sugar or get an insulin shot in public. However, this technology makes diabetes management painless.
The innovative device isn't yet available. However, Professor Kim expects it may take about 5 years to get it certified and on the market. There are well over 400 million diabetics worldwide, and the number is on the rise. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. Syrian peace talks suffered a major setback on Tuesday after airstrikes killed about 40 people in a crowded vegetable market in rebel-held territory. The Syrian opposition said a truce with the government of President Bashar al-Assad was finished and it would stay away from the Geneva-based negotiations indefinitely. For more on that story, I spoke on the phone a short while ago with Borzu Deragahi. He is a Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News in London currently, but usually based in Istanbul. And I asked him what he knows about who carried out these airstrikes.
It's not clear who has carried out the airstrikes. It's largely believed to be by the Syrian government. This is all in the context of the collapse of a rather surprisingly successful weeks-long cessation of hostilities between the Syrian government and its Russian and Iranian sponsors on one side and the some of the Syrian rebel groups on the other side, most of the mainstream Syrian rebel groups. And this ceasefire, cessation of hostilities, has been deteriorating sort of steadily over the last few weeks as each side has tried, mostly the regime, to sort of gain advantage from the cessation of hostilities. But things really took a turn for the worse today. Airstrikes, likely by the Syrian government, struck a marketplace in the town of Marat al-Noman. This is in Idlib province in the northwest of Syria. And at least 40 people were killed. The scenes were horrific. If you see the videos on social media, just people holding their broken bodies of their children, blood everywhere, destroyed buildings, destroyed human beings, people screaming, crying, rescue workers struggling to get to the scene. Just a really ugly scene in this town.
So most of the information about the airstrikes on this town of Marat al-Noman, is that coming from social media?
It's coming from trusted social media resources that have proven accurate in the past. Sadly, because of the situation in Syria right now, we're not able to get Western correspondents into that part of the country or most of the parts of the country. But in recent weeks, I have spoken to a Syrian-American activist who managed to make his way into Marat al-Noman. He's a law student in the U.S., and he went there. He went to this town, and he gave me a lot of information over the course of an interview about what's happening there and the sort of political dynamics there. And that's what's sort of interesting about this particular target. The Russians and the Syrians claim that they are targeting the extremists, targeting the Islamic State or ISIS or Daesh, as it's called, and Jabhat al-Nusra, or the Nusra Front. This is the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. But this is one town, Marat al-Noman, where the people, the townspeople, the civil society, activists, organizations, even women and others have been actively fighting against the influence of the extremists. This is very much documented, especially Jabhat al-Nusra, which has sought to establish a stronghold over this particular city. So it's, perhaps very, very depressing, definitely, but perhaps very telling that the Syrian regime chose, of all places, to strike at the one town where ordinary, moderate U.S. and other country-backed civil society forces are fighting against the extremists.
Okay, well, we'll have to see if and when the Syrian government does say something about this incident. Thank you very much to Borzu Daragahi, Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News, for speaking to VOA's International Edition.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Well, U.S. health officials are raising the alarm about the health effects of the Zika virus, saying it's now clear that it can cause microcephaly in newborn babies and other birth defects. Cases of Zika also have been growing here in the United States. We focused on the threat of Zika in this week's hashtag VOA television show, which I hosted today along with Andrew Polchevsky. One of our guests was Anne Schuchat. She is the principal deputy director for the U.S. Centers of Disease Control, and she joined us from Atlanta. I asked Dr. Schuchat what the latest information is about the threat of Zika in the continental United States.
Much of what we are expecting with Zika virus is based on what we've seen with other viruses that are similarly spread through mosquito bites. So we look at the patterns of disease we've seen with dengue virus and with chikungunya, more recently a virus that's been spreading in the Americas more recently. Both of those viruses have been seen in travelers in the continental U.S., and we have had some local transmission, but it's been very minimal, small outbreaks, handfuls of cases, not thousands or tens of thousands of cases. But you know, what we've discussed with the state and local health leadership around the country is the need to be ready. There have already been so many surprises with the Zika virus. The idea that the virus can be spread sexually was a total surprise to us. We want to be ready, and so we think it's very important for states and counties to be carrying out surveillance for human disease, to have their lab assay working. We think it's important for them to be doing mosquito surveillance and to have plans on how they'll control mosquitoes. The way the states and cities around the United States control mosquitoes against West Nile virus is very different than the way they'll need to control the Aedes aegypti mosquito or the Aedes albopictus mosquito, which is in a little bit further northern states. So we just think this is a critical time for public health to be ready, to be working across the different sectors of human disease, and mosquito or animal control, to have the laboratory active, to have communication work going on, and to be doing surveillance for birth defects. We know that pregnant women and others travel back and forth to areas where the virus is spreading, and we really need our clinicians and our public health experts to be ready.
Yes, can I just ask, you talked about some isolated cases of local transmission. Does that mean that mosquitoes are already spreading the virus in the United States, and if so, where?
Well, this is not happening right today, but in years past, when we've had dengue circulating, we have had some local transmission in southern Florida and southern Texas, and the same with chikungunya, that we have seen that really just in the Florida Keys. So I think we need to be prepared in Florida and Texas and the Gulf states, but the range of the virus is somewhat bigger, and so we can't promise that there won't be a problem. The issue is when people return from areas where the virus is circulating, the virus may be in their bloodstream for a bit of time. We think it's really important for people to apply insect repellent if they come back from the Caribbean or Central or South America. Apply insect repellent for a couple weeks. So if you get bitten by a mosquito here in the continental US, you won't spread the virus to our mosquitoes.
And that was Dr. Anne Schuchat, Principal Deputy Director for the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. You can hear more of that program by watching the full hashtag show on our website at voanews.com/hashtag VOA. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. This Friday marks the International Observance of Earth Day. It's a day when world leaders are due to come together to sign the global climate change agreement they negotiated in Paris in December. As VOA's Roseanne Scribble reports, on Monday this week, a contingency of faith leaders issued a statement expressing solidarity with the pact and the need for rapid action to put it into force.
Religious and lay leaders joined in prayer at the chapel of the Church Center for the United Nations. They affirmed the sanctity of the earth. They came to deliver an interfaith climate statement to the president of the UN General Assembly. 250 eminent faith leaders, including the Dalai Lama and South African social rights activist Desmond Tutu, had signed the document, which urges heads of state to quickly sign, ratify, and implement the Paris Climate Agreement. Some 5,000 individuals and 90 groups worldwide also signed the statement. Fletcher Harper is executive director of Green Faith, an interfaith coalition that helped organize the event. He says the statement reflects spiritual and moral values shared by all traditions.
We must regard the earth as a gift, not just as a commodity that can be bought or sold, but as a gift that must be cherished and protected, not only for short-term economic gain, but for the long-term protection of life.
In the UN chapel, faith leaders stepped forward to express solidarity with the climate statement. Among them was Karen Bally, global chairperson for the United Religions Initiative, the largest global interfaith organization, which is active in 94 countries. She calls the worsening droughts, food shortages, and species extinctions made worse by climate change a human and spiritual failure.
And I'm here to ask for everybody to unite, to come together as people of faith who believe in the values of oneness and respect, environmental stewardship, and really save our planet, save our earth.
Faith leaders called on governments to move from fossil fuels to renewable energy sources. This would help curb warming emissions and keep temperature rise below 2 degrees Celsius compared with pre-industrial times. 80% of the world's population identify with a religious tradition, says Harper, who is also an Episcopal minister. He says those communities are in a unique position to push a new climate agenda.
by mobilizing the support and the commitment of these communities on climate change, we have a chance to transform the cultures of the world, and by transforming the cultures, transform politics, so that government leaders understand that they absolutely must take dramatic action on climate change now.
Then Stephen Chu of the Buddhist Tzu China Foundation handed the Interfaith Climate Statement to the UN General Assembly President, who promised to deliver it to UN member states.
Thank you very much.
Accompanied by a Sikh prayer song, the crowd left more determined than ever to translate their words into action. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
A popular Kenyan cartoon series, Tinga Tinga Tales, has been adapted into a live musical performance. In the stage version, the actors dress up as animals and other characters to teach children African folk tales. Lenny Rivaga watched the show and filed this report about why it's proving to be a big hit.
This performance tells the tale of why the chameleon changes color. Tinga Tinga started as a Kenyan animated TV series in 2010. Tinga, 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 tinga. In the stage version, acclaimed actor John Sibi Okumu plays Mr. Simba, which is Swahili for lion.
It's a different type of acting. So for this is audience participation, drawing a response and seeing people with very happy, happy, smiling faces and shaking hands and dancing with mum and dad.
So far, around 5,000 children have watched the musical.
I liked it because I watch Tinga Tinga most of the times, and it's funny.
If you teach kids with creativity and imagination, their minds open up.
Claudia Lloyd created both the TV show and the musical.
It allows them to kind of realize that they've got choices in life and they can make up stories and everything isn't by rote. So it's very important to me that Tinga is fantastical and full of imagination and creativity.
Lloyd says she plans to adapt more of the show's episodes for the stage. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
That's a wrap of International Edition on The Voice of America. My thanks to director Tracy Carter and engineer Zaina Abdul-Rahman. And also a shout out to VOA's new director, Amanda Bennett, who is watching us from the control room. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. We'll see you later.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This month marks the second anniversary of the kidnapping of more than 200 Nigerian girls from their school in Chibok by the terrorist group Boko Haram. These girls, between the ages of 16 and 18, were captured while at their boarding school. The United States again calls for the immediate release without preconditions of all hostages held by Boko Haram. Nigeria's military has succeeded in driving Boko Haram out of its strongholds, leaving it seriously weakened. Nevertheless, across northeastern Nigeria and in neighboring countries such as Cameroon and southern Niger, Boko Haram continues to wreak havoc. They relentlessly attack villages, murder countless individuals, and kidnap civilians, including women and girls, some of whom are subjected to forced labor and sex slavery through forced marriages to Boko Haram terrorists. Amnesty International reported that Boko Haram in 2015 and 2016 had abducted at least 2,000 women. According to a recently released UNICEF report, Boko Haram uses children to detonate bombs. Indeed, nearly one of every five such attacks carried out by the terrorist group last year used a child, and more than two-thirds of those were girls. The United States continues to assist the Nigerian government with intelligence and advisory support in an effort to locate and bring home all of those who have been kidnapped by Boko Haram. In the last 2 years, the United States has provided nearly $198 million in humanitarian assistance to the region to deliver conflict-affected populations with transitional assistance, counseling services, health programs, and emergency education for children displaced by violence. The United States continues to stand with the people of the Lake Chad Basin to combat the deadly scourge of Boko Haram.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.